Welcome back to Be Fit with Brian Pruitt. I'm your host, and this podcast is all about getting and staying fit for life, physically, mentally, and spiritually. This episode is a powerful one as it relates to mental health. May, as you know, was the official month for mental health awareness. And I believe it's never been a more important time to not only talk about mental health and how to improve your brain health, improve your mental health, but also give you practical solutions that are backed by science, backed by research. And so my interviewer today, my interviewee, my guest today is an amazing, incredible woman, Gabby Bodkin. She's a licensed mental health counselor. She's worked with kids ranging from a young age to, you know, adults. Her background is robust. She's done a lot of good in the world, and she's an incredible person, people person. She is has amazing energy. And what she does in this episode is she gives so much analytical and scientific, background and context. And then we kind of have a great conversation because I remind her, like, hey, explain it to me like I'm a third grader, because I kind of am. And so I think you'd appreciate the bridge that we gapped here, where it's going to be pretty deep stuff and very analytical, but also down to earth, also simple in nature. And she did such a great job of that. She truly is one of our best friends, my wife Gigi and I. Gabby and her husband Josh is the person that I'm in, creative buddy here at the studio. So they're some of our favorite people in the world, best friends. And I really, truly hope this episode brings you life. It brings you solutions. It reminds you, you are not alone. People go through trauma, they go through abuse, we go through loss as humans. No one is, we're basically all susceptible to life. No one is exempt from this. That's the word I'm trying to use. And so with that being said, this episode is going to be a powerful upgrade to your mental health in terms of awareness, and also give you practical solutions and advice and hopefully tips to upgrade your mental health, to improve your brain health, to stay mentally fit. So without further ado, Gabby Bodkin, my awesome guest, enjoy this podcast. All right. So, we're in the studio. What do you think of the setup, by the way? Because this is, did I just go out? No. This is mostly your husband's artistic eye. So what do you think?
I think it's great. It's very calming. It's very relaxing and comfortable. So
all,
10 out of 10.
All important things for the mental.
Yeah.
For sure. So how's your week so far? How's the day?
Day is great. Very relaxing morning. Just kind of prepping for this and then... That's about it.
I'm so glad to have you on, like, for a conversation. It's Mental Health Awareness Month in May. Mm-hmm. We're recording this on the 18th, and I feel like it's like such a big, it's such a big deal to like raise awareness, mm-hmm. but also like what I want to do in this conversation is give people practical strategies. Talk about like your experience with it, what you do. Mm. I mean, you got so much experience, so much wisdom in the area. I feel like it's going to be like a really powerful combo.
I hope so. And I'm very appreciative that you brought me on and love talking about all things mental health or holistic healing. So
heck yeah.
This is great.
I was going to say, let's just a little bit closer right there. Okay. Because my listeners love hearing me close to the mic. No, I'm kidding. But so Gabby and I actually went to high school together.
Yes.
And so you were way too smart for me. I was in most of the general classes.
That's
you had
not
a couple
true.
Good classes, didn't you?
I did take a few, but you know, school wasn't my top thing back then either.
Yeah.
It kind of evolved as I continued on in my career.
Yes. And then we went to the same college.
Yes, we
FGCU.
Did.
Yep. And you became friends with my wife Gigi, but girlfriend at the time. How did y'all meet again?
We had a class together, and it was a kind of a joke of a class, and we didn't have the best professor, and the only way that we got through that class was just kind of goofing off, in a sense, and leaning on each other and having fun. It was a summer class, so Gigi took us wakeboarding, and her, me, and myself, and another friend.
Yeah.
So we just got a really close friendship really quick through that class.
I was going to say, nothing brings people closer together than like a shared, like, this sucks, you know? And that could be an enemy, which is like the unhealthy way to like think about it. But truly, like, if you have a class that sucks or a job that sucks, like, yeah, you really do bond, which is interesting. Yeah. It's part of, I feel like, human nature to maybe like figure out a way to get through it. But that's really good. And for those of you who don't know Gabby, obviously most of you don't, but she is the wife of my buddy here at the studio, Josh, who is an incredible artist, storyteller, one of my best friends, if not the best friend. And they're just like the same people. Like, you are so similar to Gigi, and we just get along great. So anyway, I wanted to ask, like, so did you know you were going to get into like this, the thing you're doing now? Like, number one, what do you do for a living? Okay. And how'd you like get into it? Did you fall into it?
It kind of evolved throughout my life, but I knew as a really young child that I had the biggest heart, lots of empathy and compassion, and I wanted to be in a field of helping people. And so that changed. Like, one year I wanted to be a lawyer, one year I wanted to be a doctor. I'm pretty squeamish and don't love blood, so I was like, okay, I'm not going to be a doctor.
Nope. Checked off.
I actually had a background in piano. That was my hobby in high school, and thought I wanted to be a music therapy teacher. So just kind of, I had a really good foundation in childhood of my dad, who really taught me about the need for physical health, the importance of moving your body. My mom taught me, she had a nutrition background and taught me all the things about how important it is to fuel your body with nutrient-dense things. And then I had a grandmother who enforced holistic healing over medicine. So those three foundations kind of paved the way for just like my overall appreciation for health and wellness. And then when I went into undergrad, I actually was undecided because I decided I did not want to pursue music and lose my passion for piano. So I just went in undecided, and then I took a lot of general psych classes, loved learning about the brain. And then a guidance counselor called me up and she's like, you have all these classes in social sciences. Do you want to just declare your major in psychology? I'm like, that's a great idea. So I did.
She was your guide.
Yes.
Yeah.
So that was kind of how it all transitioned. And then now I'm well into the career and field, and couldn't have picked a better place to land. So
honestly, that's beautiful. I mean, it's so great seeing people do what they are really like made to do. I feel like you're very aligned in that. To your point, you're very empathetic. You're a people person, and it's just beautiful to see, because the world needs like what you have to give.
Right.
Like that's a really profound idea. So you're in the right place. It's amazing. And that might look different over the years, but you're doing what comes natural to you. And you're, to your point, like having a dad, having a mother, having a grandmother, you said aunt.
Grandmother.
Having a support system like that is so, so big. And so your dad's like the man, someone I want to be when I get older, for sure. He prioritizes everything, body, mind, spirit, health. So that's amazing. So you got into it because you really want to help people. Now, what do you think, question like right off the bat is like, okay, so I know what you do, I know why you do it, but like, what's a misconception maybe that people may have, like the general pop might have to mental health? Like, is there a misconception that's common that you're like, oh, I wish people knew the truth?
Well, my main mission and what I do now, which I didn't explain fully, but I'm a licensed mental health counselor. So my undergrad was in psychology, and then I went on to get my master's in clinical mental health counseling. And in my master's program, we had to be placed at different internships. And one of my first real, like, working internships was at a child protection center. So I got to work with kids, you know, my end goal, but they all experienced trauma. So I got to see, like, the profound impact trauma had in these children and families. And then every other placement that I had in my master's program, I couldn't run away from trauma.
Interesting.
So I learned that that's really, like, the root of so many mental health issues. And now doing what I do now, which I transitioned from working with children to adults with childhood trauma and helping them go back and heal from these early life experiences. And I'm kind of shifting the verbiage to brain health. So when we think about mental health, it's how we think, feel, and act. And brain health is taking into consideration how the brain as an organ operates in conjunction with the emotion and thinking and all of those things.
Interesting.
So my whole mission is for people to understand the body first, understand how the brain works, how the body responds to different life events, and then kind of go from there with learning about yourself and behaviors and healing if there is any significant trauma from your childhood.
That's fascinating. I think I was in a room in Scottsdale, Arizona, and there was a woman who was talking about childhood trauma and just, you know, she did the whole, like, raise your hand if you've experienced this, this, and this. And she listed out certain things. Did my audio go out?
No.
Okay. She listed certain things and, you know, it all related to either abuse or, you know, verbal, physical, divorce, all these traumatic events, right?
Yeah.
And, like, the whole room was holding their hands up. Like, it's so crazy how much trauma is a normal thing. And obviously there's bigger like things at the root level. But I love that because we're gonna get into, okay, how do we heal from trauma? Like, what's the process? What's the stages, practical ways? But I think the follow-up question there, because I love that. So the mind, you said, the brain is an organ.
Yeah.
And then what's in that, or how does it connect with the emotions and thoughts and experiences, memory?
So it's kind of complex, but I'll try to simplify it. So we
talk to me like I'm a third grader, because everyone listening will appreciate you.
Well, I used to work with kids, but I mean, I really want people to understand. So the brain and spinal cord makes up our central nervous system.
Yeah.
So those are the two kind of like key operating systems. And then from that, we have, this is just a big term, but peripheral nervous system, which is just all the nerve endings that stem from our brain and our spine.
Okay.
So everything is connected, all the nerve endings that go to every organ, every, you know, gland, muscle, everything is connected, and it sends a signal back to the brain.
In a split.
Oh, so
less than a split.
So immediately. So we're constantly in communication between different body parts, and so the peripheral nervous system that has all the nerves is broken down into two categories. We have our stressed response and our not stressed response.
Mm.
So our sympathetic nervous system is our fight or flight, which also goes into freeze or fawn. So there's different stress responses.
Yeah. Mm.
And then our relaxed state, which is our parasympathetic. So I know we speak a lot about breath work. That would be turning on that relaxed state. So all of the nerves can communicate to our brain and to say, we are not in danger. Because our human body is wired to know if we're in danger or not.
Right.
It's constantly scanning our environment through all of our senses. And it's taking in information and it's kind of rating it. Is this a threat or is this not a threat?
Right.
In our day to day.
Yeah.
Like, we have so much stress in the world, and it's because that's what our body's wired to do.
Mm-hmm.
So that's just key for everybody to understand, of those two states of stressed or not stressed, and the implications that it has on the entire body system is really important. And trauma really is at the root of that, because once we experience a threat, our brain stores that threat and that memory so deeply.
Mm-hmm.
It's the sight, smell, sound, touch, taste, hearing. Like, everything related to that threat. So that
and imagination
way,
too,
yeah,
right?
And instinct.
Yeah.
So anytime the brain picks up information saying, oh, that's familiar to a time when I felt threatened, it sends off this alarm system. And that alarm system is that stress response state. And what it's doing is it's shutting down our digestive system. It's not saying we need to focus on food right now. It's saying we're in a state of threat.
Yeah.
We need to survive.
Yeah.
So our heart rate picks up. We release adrenaline and cortisol to survive whatever that moment is.
Right.
And we're not only talking like big scale things like, you know, car accidents or like fires, anything.
Acute natural events.
Little things can turn on that system.
Right.
And that kind of gets into the nutrition thing of why fasting is so prevalent now is when you're not digesting, you're healing. And when you're turning that system on and off, your body's just like out of whack.
Yeah, yeah.
Am I stressed? Am I not stressed?
Interesting.
And I didn't go into that in full detail to really comprehend it, but basically our body's very cool.
It's our bodies are legitimately like wild, mind-blowing. Like,
yes.
Like I truly believe there's a design behind it as well as the universe.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's like a fascinating thing to study. I think you were in the room. I was like, you could spend your whole life studying your fingertip. Like, it's true. This is a universe of information that you could pull out, which is crazy. But the question I had, Gabby, when you were talking, I was like, oh, that's an interesting point. So when we feel ourselves in that sympathetic versus parasympathetic,
mm-hmm.
and obviously breath work, we just chatted about that before we hit record, that's a powerful tool to switch on, like, or to at least have your mind follow your body, because that's a physical mm-hmm. act. What are some other ways like you maybe can share with the people that change your sympathetic to parasympathetic? Like, how can you calm yourself mm-hmm. In simple ways?
So simple could be, I always kind of break it up into a few categories. The first is something that you could do just with yourself. So mm-hmm. you don't need resources. It's things like breath work. There's mindfulness, grounding techniques, ways to kind of stay present in the here and now, not thinking about past, not, you know, stressing about future. There's tapping techniques. There's certain things that you can do, like guided imagery and just using your mind to take yourself to a safe place or a comfortable space to kind of calm down.
Mm.
So the brain actually doesn't distinguish between I'm closing my eyes and visualizing a safe place and I'm there versus not being there. It thinks we're there. So it can allow ourselves time to get back into that parasympathetic state. So that would be the first element, is just using your body for mm-hmm. relaxation. The second would be something that's very easy to access, like whether it's music, because we're always having our phones on us, or something that can calm us down and detach us from what's causing us stress.
Mm.
And then the third would be something that might take a lot more effort and energy, like going for a run, moving your body, going to get a massage or acupuncture, whatever healing remedy you want. So mm-hmm. those would be kind of how I classify.
I love that. And you can use those practices to stop that snowball of, wow, I'm getting overwhelmed. I'm really like, you know, and you start mm-hmm. feeling that anxiety rise. So you can kind of
They're quick interventions to keep it from spiraling. And they're also, they can be self-care practices. Mm-hmm. So if we think stress builds and our body like takes a toll as we're not releasing these things and these emotions. So if we're doing these things daily and we've established consistency in having some self-care remedies and things like that, then we're helping to balance out those systems.
Right. So the mind, this is a fascinating idea too, is like the mind, the body follows the mind. For instance, if you're stressed, if you're overwhelmed, your body kind of like, to your point, it sends the signals and you start breathing shallow.
Mm-hmm.
You're up top, it's very short, shallow breaths, and then in turn it signals again like, oh yeah, we are stressed, and it's almost like that momentum builds mm-hmm. in a negative way. But then conversely, like, you know, Tony Robbins and some mm-hmm. of those guys who are like, and I'm sure you might even do it with your clients, but like the power pose or like the victory
mm-hmm.
stance
mm-hmm. Yeah.
and the power pose before interviews, like we should do them right now. But it's like that idea, the mind also follows the body.
Yes.
Which is beautiful. So it's like, that's what I want to like continue helping people just gain some autonomy mm-hmm. over their lives, where it's like, well, if I am struggling with mental health, I can use physical acts. I can use my body. Mm-hmm. I can change my physiological state and reap some rewards mentally, right?
Mm-hmm.
So is there anything that, you know, it fascinates you about the mind-muscle connection, or like, how do you see that?
It's exactly what you described. Like, it's a bilateral communication between the mind and body. So it doesn't matter if it starts in our thoughts or it starts in our actions or behaviors. The signal's going back and forth between the two.
Yeah.
So I don't know if you've heard, there's like something that you can do, or we tell people to do at times, which is just smile. Like, have you heard of the walk around smiling?
Absolutely.
And it's so interesting because your brain will start to fill in the blanks to be like, I'm smiling, therefore I'm feeling joy and pleasure. And then we start seeing the world as we're walking down the street, smiling and looking a little awkward, but we're like, wow, that tree's beautiful. And
wow,
this is a great day. So there's things like that. There's also like opposite action, the physical feeling of anxiety and the physical feeling of excitement is very similar. So this is something that I've practiced a lot, especially like having to test so many times for big exams in my career and things like that. But I would have to trick myself to say, okay, this anxious feeling that I have, I'm going to pretend, and I know that it's excitement because I know I can do this.
Yeah.
I'm going to focus on this pleasant emotion and feeling versus the unpleasant thing that it also feels like. So little shifts like that can be helpful.
That's amazing because, and I tried to pull the mic back, but we're not able to go that far.
Oh, you can try.
No, you're fine. You're fine. But that's super powerful, Gabby. I think, so I had that call with a company talking about mental health, talking about breath work and mindfulness. And so we're like, obviously like we have some of the same interests, although you're much more knowledgeable, experienced in it. And that's why I'm so stoked we're having this conversation. But before I did that call, I'm 100% on board with what you're saying. I use, and I could be off the deep end with the word feeling association, but I'm very, very intentional the past couple of years about the words I use, especially out loud, because I feel like it's more powerful, but even in my head. So to your point, I'm like, no, you're excited. And whenever someone asks me like, hey, you ready? I'm like, yeah, I'm excited. Can't wait. Even if I'm nervous, especially actually when I'm nervous.
That's super powerful. And it's great that, you know, it takes us a long time to figure those things out.
It's training.
On our own. Yeah.
It's like that mental
and
fitness.
And to put that connection. I always think of like our belief systems and the narratives that we tell ourselves as like, I describe it as like a blank field with just soil. And you're planting seeds. Something somebody tells you is a seed planted, something you believe about yourself is a seed planted, and it's going to grow into like a very deep-rooted tree system. And that tree system is either going to be toxic or not toxic. And those toxic trees, it's hard because these are called our schemas of views, how we see ourselves and the world. Once we plant that seed, it's like we have a magnifying glass and we're looking for more evidence for that thing. So if your first experiences in early life is an unsupportive upbringing, saying you can't do this, that's a seed that's planted, and then that's going to be a seed that's going to be reaffirmed as you move through life, and it's going to grow, and it's going to be very deeply rooted, and it's going to be very hard to change. So I think, I know you said there's a lot of misconception, or asking me about the misconceptions. These, to change the brain and the way that it's wired is not a very quick fix. Like it does take time and effort and lots of repetition, especially when we think about our belief systems about ourselves, about the world. Because these are things that have been confirmed throughout our whole life. And then we're saying, you know, I don't like the way this feels. I need to be really intentional about it. And then it's staying consistent and intentional how you're describing yourself to be with it, which takes a lot of dedication and energy. The energy it takes.
Awareness and mindfulness.
Yeah. So it's really powerful.
Well, that's a good question too. That's a good segue because like consistency plays such a big role in physical fitness, mental fitness, spiritual fitness, whatever you want to go with. I mean, the act of showing up and repeating something, that's how we learn. The mother of all learning is repetition, right? And so unfortunately, we can also do that negatively. And so I love what you said there. How does consistency play a role? Because, and I guess maybe the question is, like, I believe too, some change can happen like instantly. But also to your point, like you're not just going to change and get over a traumatic event like in the moment. So maybe it's just that like constant reframing where you do experience some change. Like that's not who I am or that doesn't define me. I'm not sure. But how does that consistency, how can you cultivate a consistent approach to your mental health?
Well, consistency is key for that moving forward and thinking about future and goals and where you want to go. But I would think, I would say the first piece of that is to kind of look backwards to see what consistency has looked like in your life.
Interesting.
And there's most likely patterns of behavior of, you know, we get on a new thing, whether it's wellness related or hobby or anything that we're kind of moving forward.
Knitting.
Yes. Yeah. Moving forward to. And lots of times it's, I'm going to start this thing. It's great for a while. and then we stop. And I think there's reasons for that stopping, and it might be these deep-rooted belief systems. It might be unaddressed trauma. It might be not going back to say, how is it that I got to where I am today? And what has influenced me and my behaviors, and what patterns have I maintained consistency with throughout my life to then say, okay, how can I stay consistent moving forward?
Right.
Because if we're not looking back to evaluate and to know like the deep workings of our behavior and thought processes, then it's going to be very hard to like move forward and stay consistent.
That's fire. So look back to move forward.
Yes.
What's most important, like the past, the present, or the future?
All of them are important. I mean, working in trauma, obviously, I have a very skewed perspective where I understand trauma. I understand the prevalence of it. It's 60% of Americans have experienced at least one adverse childhood experience. And I can get into that study if you think that's interesting for listeners, but have had something really, a really big event happen in childhood. That's most of us. And a lot of people don't report, obviously, traumatic experiences. So I think that number is even higher. So
for
a
sure,
lot of
like
times,
the guilt or shame that's associated, for sure.
And a lot of times the natural human instinct is to repress, like have access to these memories, but we're going to ignore that they're there. Or we're going to say, you know, these early life experiences and beliefs that I have about myself, they're not a big deal, and kind of minimize it.
Right.
The next phase of that is our natural instinct to suppress information. Like, it's very deeply there, and we're not even going to acknowledge it. It's not coming up, but we've buried it with a lot of unhealthy coping skills or whatever it is. And then the third way our body protects ourselves is through dissociation of our brain. If we've experienced a trauma that's really creating this huge wound, we have ways of our brain turning off access to those memories.
Wow.
Which is a very deeper conversation.
I think Josh mentioned that one day where it's, I mean, that's fascinating. It's awful in context, obviously, if your body has to do something to that extreme to disassociate. Yeah. But it's also fascinating where it provides some type of relief mentally, because you're just, I don't know, but
which it sounds gloomy and depressing, but in all of that, you know, we just have to acknowledge that trauma is there, and that these beliefs and things, that way that we see ourselves, they're very impactful moving forward. But the good news is that our brain is malleable. So when you talk about consistency, you know, we can do something really well for a while, get off that pattern. Maybe we have an unhealthy pattern of consistency. We're, you know, using substances to cope or things like that. But that doesn't mean it's permanent. We just have to work hard to redirect that neurological path of behavior. And a lot of things with consistency comes into the dopamine reward cycle of the brain.
Yeah.
Of what's being rewarded.
It's hard to get around that, for sure.
That's the difficult part, because the brain chooses what it thinks is crucial for survival, and then two, what brings the most pleasure and joy in the short term. It doesn't have the capacity to say, oh, this is pleasure and joy for the long term. So it makes it a little bit tricky of what's being reinforced.
And that's a really good, I'm just always thinking like fitness and health and wellness, like that's a very good skill to work on to be able to have success, because part of what discipline means for me is saying no to the thing you want right now for the thing you want most. So like saying yes to the thing you want most instead of the thing you want right now. And sometimes it's not black and white. In fact, most of the time it's not. It's more gray, but that is interesting. I think, what do you think plays the biggest role in that? Is it perspective or wisdom or knowledge? Like, how do you go from being very reactive and kind of a victim to the whole, I want this right now, and I'm going to do anything to get it? Is there ways you can go from very reactive type of person to a more intentional, more self-serving, like healthy-minded person?
Yeah, so the first way to do that would be to acknowledge what are the issues or what are the patterns that are impacting you. And whenever we talk about brain health issues, it's one, what are they specifically? What are the symptoms? patterns of behavior? And then two, how is it impacting me in my day to day? How is it not aligning with my goals? Mm-hmm. How is it affecting my relationships, my functioning at work, just regular functioning? So figuring out what it is first, which I think having that foundation of the brain and body can help you go back and have that awareness. And then it would be looking back to say, why was this established in the first place? Any unhealthy pattern that was easy to be consistent with, that got rewarded through our reward system and mm-hmm. dopamine in the brain, was there for a reason.
Yeah.
Either we were gaining social connection because we were, you know, doing drugs or, you know, drinking alcohol, mm-hmm. and then that reinforced that behavior. Or it was, we did have a tough childhood and we needed an escape, or we needed to numb the pain.
Right.
So figuring out why it was there in the first place, that's that how question and looking back. And then you can say, okay, now I understand. My body wanted me to do these things to cope and to survive these hardships. And it became a pattern, and it was a reinforced pattern. But now that I'm aware of it, I can then say, this isn't something that needs to still be a pattern.
Right.
Especially with addictive behaviors, there's a lot of people think it's genetic. It's all trauma.
Wow.
Trauma, like, is the foundation. And really? When we think about genetic trauma, living in a household with one caregiver that has substance use issues, the next caregiver will, because that was the trauma of living in that environment,
right,
rather than it being a gene that is for alcoholism or substance use.
That's a misconception, I feel like.
That's a huge misconception. Yeah. And
we always talk
the
about
research will say both ways, but like working with trauma and knowing that nearly every single person that I've encountered that has substance use histories also had a trauma, at least one.
So nature versus nurture, it's more gray.
It's more gray. There's a huge wave of research coming out on epigenetics of turning genes on and off.
Right.
So there might be a dormant gene for some sort of mental health diagnosis. And that gene's not necessarily going to turn on if that parent has a child. Hmm. What's going to turn it on is the environment that they're in. If that child has a gene for like behaviors that would be like schizophrenic behaviors, and that child's born into a nurturing and safe environment and hasn't experienced trauma, the likelihood of that gene getting turned on and expressed with that same diagnosis is very rare.
Right.
But giving in the environmental context of nurture, of having that experience, then it can be turned on.
Yeah.
And it's the same with alcoholism and substance use and things like that.
Love that. And I do want, if you want to share some stuff from the studies, your favorite studies, by all means. But before we get into the stages of trauma, like, because I kind of want to give, if anyone out there's like got trauma they're wrestling with, struggling with, no doubt there's plenty of people that are, you know, how one goes from struggling with suppression and depression, and how one then can step into the light and live freely and kind of like look back on that, hopefully one day with understanding and maybe empathize and give grace to themselves and then walk forward with hope, which is what we all need. Before I ask you that question, what's the number one most, the biggest factor in someone's mental health? Like from that standpoint, because when you were talking, my mind goes, Gabby, to like this instance where you have brother, sister, or identical twins in the same family. Same thing happens to them, let's say, same events, but one goes one way, one goes the other. So what do you think like the biggest factor in like long-term overall mental wellness is? You chatted about like beliefs, like if you believe in God or have hope, maybe that's a deciding factor. But I'm curious if there's anything else that comes to mind.
Well, those twin studies, for example, are very interesting because it is true. Like we do have this individual aspect to ourselves where same life experiences, but how we view and see the world is a little bit different. It depends on what information our brain decided to take in as necessary and what information our brain decided to filter out. So that's where the individual nature of things comes into play. For those specific studies. But the brain I can't look at without taking into consideration like the whole body. And I think for somebody to be mentally healthy, have a healthy brain, they've acknowledged any past traumas, they have an understanding of how it functions. they incorporate nutrition and movement into their daily routine and understand the value of those three things. So I don't think you can treat the brain and any mental health disorders without those other two, movement and nutrition.
Yeah.
I think it's a disservice if it's only one.
Yeah, it'd be naive to think it's like separate. That's really good. Now, so fascinating, this whole idea of just the connection and how we all kind of deal with this. And I'm learning stuff right now just from hearing you talk. So I love it.
It's a lot to digest.
It is. And I think, it's just so fascinating. Do you believe things happen for a reason, or do you think there's a good amount of chance involved? Like, what's your belief on that? What's your perspective?
That's such a good question.
Is it?
And I'm laughing because I struggle with this.
And this can be personal. Like, you talked about, like, clinically, like, you have this. But, you know, personally, I'm curious.
Well, it's hard because I have such a different view of the world. I've sat in front of countless families and children, and I've heard stories that nobody should hear or even live through. And I've, like, grieved for those stories and experiences that I've heard people go through. So... I don't understand how some of these things happen, like the torture and abuse and just terrible things. But I also do. Like, I think, you know, our brain is wired and our body is wired to survive. And we have certain needs, foundational needs. We need our physical need of sleep, water, food. Then we need safety. Then we need to feel love and belong. And that's, I think, the element where... You know, as a society, it comes down to parenting and how the kids grow up. Do they feel love? Do they feel nurtured? And that kind of shapes future behavior of, are these kids going to grow up to love and nurture others, or are they going to grow up and hurt and harm in adulthood? So I think a lot of it is just how the brain works and how we're wired. But then there's things that happen, and I'm like, you know, that's very odd by chance, like I can't explain from a psychological perspective. And that's where I kind of question things in that regard. But I think
for
it's,
sure it's very no that's a great that's a great that was very well said. It's fascinating that we are creatures that look for meaning to be drawn out of situations, because you'll have someone who has survived one of the worst things, like maybe a story you're talking about. And it's like, how the heck can you come out the other side of that? But it's like, for some odd reason or some divine reason, they found a way to. And that's pretty powerful, because I really do believe there's always hope.
Oh, me too.
If you have breath in your lungs, you have a heartbeat, like, there's hope. And so I think when you lose hope, you kind of lose that reason to live, and that's not good for mental or physical health.
And there's so many people that get stuck in that, you know, that was a terrible life experience, and then that wound is too big and it kind of spirals out of control, and they might not have access to the things they need to overcome it. And the things that they would need access to would be a supportive and safe environment.
That, like, pyramid of needs.
Exactly.
Foundational all the way up.
And for trauma specifically, like, we can't heal from trauma unless we're not in a state of threat or perceived threat. So if somebody experienced childhood trauma and then they're in a series of unhealthy relationships and they're still in that relationship, going back and asking their hows and whys and trying to heal from that is impossible. Like, we have to have our body in a state of non-perceived threat and calmness in order to go back and heal. But the body is capable of healing. Like, we regenerate nerves, make new connections. The brain is really fascinating in that way. So having a support system, understanding why, that's the biggest thing, I think, in my work, of just helping people normalize and or understand and normalizing what they went through and their response to it, then it kind of eliminates that guilt and shame. And that's a big piece of people's struggle.
That's good.
Is if they can learn, your body did exactly what many other people's bodies would do, given the state that you were in. And there's ways that our body heals from that wound, and it's might be unhealthy coping skills, because that gave us a sense of peace and a moment of just joy or reward, or it could be, you know, a whole variety of things that that person did. And it's normal and it's okay. And
that frees you mm-hmm. from that standpoint, because exactly. shame is such a hindrance to right. growth. Do you think people, why is it that you think people, and well, first off, do you think people typically choose the negative or unhealthy coping mechanisms more than the positive?
That's a great yes. question.
Yes or no?
Yes.
Why is that?
That's because it's a lot easier for the brain to say, here I'm getting like this very...
Instant
evidence for this negative thought. Mm-hmm. To switch to say, okay, I'm going to reframe this into something positive or choose to filter this out, that takes a lot of energy. Mm. That takes the brain not in that instant moment, but it's saying, okay, we need to go back and remember all the times that someone said we could do something or whatever it is, and finding evidence for it. And that takes energy,
right.
like physical energy for our brain as an organ, as a muscle, to do that. Which is a lot more, it's a lot more work. So the brain has all of these shortcuts, and we call these thinking traps or cognitive distortions of, I'm going to think in black and white. I'm going to jump to conclusions of things.
Right.
That way I don't spend all this energy
True.
Trying to tell myself, oh, this is a positive outcome, and then just having something negative happen as a result. That's what the brain thinks. And it doesn't seem very efficient, but it's always... Did I cut out? No, we're good.
Yeah, I think that was me.
Okay. It's always erring on the side of protection.
Yeah.
And sensing things as threats.
Preservation, protection. Mm-hmm. That's really good. So that begs the question then, how do you increase the energy you have? How can you increase the chi, you know, like the energy, the life force that you have? Because I think that's what we're all trying to do. I mean, that's not a, it's never a bad thing to have mm-hmm. more in your tank of reserve, more energy.
Mm-hmm. There's a lot of ways I can answer this.
How do you do?
How do I increase energy?
Yeah.
I stay consistent. I move every day. I fuel my body with things that I know it's compatible with, that's going to give me that energy.
Because food is energy.
Food is energy. Food is fuel. I know that's a redundant phrase, but
hey, the truth needs to be repeated. If there's one thing true. I know, we have to repeat the truth to ourselves, because I just think it's, we can easily forget.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And like the food that we eat, it actually translates in our brain as it's being processed as different neurotransmitters of dopamine or serotonin, or, you know, the easiest way to explain this is like on Turkey Day, everybody right. says it makes you tired right. because of how it's processed in the neurotransmitter that yeah. stems from it. But there's foods that give us energy
totally.
And there's like nuts and things like that, whole foods.
And that comes from the gut signals.
Yes. So yeah. the gut brain is debatably, they say, the first brain, because the food arrives in your gut. Your mm-hmm. gut decides if it's toxic or not toxic, filters things out, sends signals back to the brain. How are we doing? Are we setting off this inflammatory response?
Right.
And anything that sets off that inflammatory response is sending a signal to start that sympathetic nervous system.
Interesting. It's like a small little fire that the mm-hmm. sympathetic nervous system is like,
then it's like we're in threat.
Yeah.
And now we need to gear up and have adrenaline and cortisol be pumped through our body, because now we detected something that we're not compatible with and we don't like it. Now we're going to store this information.
Right.
So what were we saying?
Ways you increase your energy.
Thank you.
Yeah. I'm surprised I actually recalled that, to be honest with you. I was tracking.
I know. They're so complex topics. I keep going off.
They are.
The other thing with movement is to increase energy. When your body stops moving, it thinks something's wrong.
Mm.
And
you like that comment in the YouTube where I said sitting kills you?
Oh, it does.
Yeah.
Like
yeah.
your brain thinks, and I honestly don't have the exact research. My uncle actually told me this, who has a background in psychology.
Phone a friend.
I know. I almost called him before here, because I was like, I want to know this statistic. But I remember him saying, your brain actually thinks you're dying. Like, if you are stagnant and sitting for too long, that stress response. And I know personally, if I am sitting, I feel so bad. I get headaches. Mm-hmm. I feel sick. I'm
foggy mentally.
Do not function well being stationary.
Yeah.
Which I know I sit a lot in my day to day, but I always have a move goal and you know, strive to reach that.
Well, and this is good because I agree, like, movement creates energy. There's mm-hmm. something beautiful about that. Getting in the sun mm-hmm. creates energy. Grounding, earthing mm-hmm. Creates energy.
All these biohacks.
Yes. Stillness, cold plunge, everything at the studio. Yeah. But, like, it's so beautiful because I think a thought I had earlier this year was, like, it's not about conserving or protecting your energy as much as it is using the energy you have now on things that actually give you more of it. Mm-hmm. So it's like, it's not about like, oh, like everyone's taking my energy. Like when I feel like that, I'm very much in a suppressed or depressed state more right. so than not. But when I'm saying, well, no, technically if there's some type of source where you can get more energy or sources, like the sunlight and like the movement, then technically I should just be more focused on staying connected to the sources that do.
Right.
And not so much of like, like I need to stop talking to you because I need to protect my energy.
Right.
Not to minimize toxic conversations or family boundaries, members that are right. abusing. Like, you know, you have to do that. But that's interesting. I totally went off on that rabbit.
No, that's good. I was going to add on to that. I mm-hmm. try to help people understand or think of energy as like, let's imagine we have a battery system, like our individual battery of, and I scale it. So 0 to 10, 10 is 100% full, 0 is depleted. Mm. See where you are during your day and like kind of check in with yourself. Mm-hmm. Like, what is my energy level at? What's draining this level? And when do I need to set a boundary to say, I am getting too depleted too quickly.
Yeah.
And if I keep going at this rate, I'm going to be at 0 and yes. I know I'm not going to function well.
Yes.
I'm not going to feel good. So tapping into that and establishing self-care practices to say, okay, I've depleted my energy or battery at like a 4 mm-hmm. and now I know I need to do something now.
Yeah, before I burn out.
Right. And then the same with like that scales can be used for distress of I'm really stressed in this environment. I need to take a break. I don't want it to get past a certain number because that's when I lose control.
Yeah.
Having just a little system in place like that can be really helpful.
So good, Gabby. So now I think of, so let's put it practically, like rubber meets the road. If I have someone in my mind who he's like, dude, Brian, there's no shot. Like I could get 10,000 steps, let's say. Mm. Or someone who just recently, I don't know, you're bedridden. Mm-hmm. Like, what are ways that you can try to protect your mental health when you aren't as, when something happens where it kind of limits your physical movement?
Yeah.
So there's two questions in that. The question I want you to answer first, if you don't mind, is what do you do? I'm bedridden for a month. Mm-hmm. How do I like protect or can like create more energy, protect my mental health? Mm-hmm. How do I do that?
So it depends on like how bedridden are we? Like, are we not able to move at all?
I broke both femurs in a skiing accident.
Thank you. So I wrote a blog post a while back on like the benefits of exercise and movement. And I don't remember the levels I created, but I created this level system of like, you know, if we can't move, mm-hmm. can you flex your muscles? Mm-hmm. Can you squeeze your hand? What body part isn't broken that you can move, which is turning on your brain to say, I'm not dying. Mm-hmm. I don't need to shut down, which initially your body will say, okay, I need to conserve and preserve my nutrients or whatever it is. But eventually muscles will atrophy and depending on how long you're bedridden. But giving your brain those signals of moving your muscles, saying, okay, they're firing. I can still move my hands. Mm-hmm. Squeezing and flexing your hands. Squeezing and flexing your forearms. There's something we use for anxiety called progressive muscle relaxation, where you can just sit, squeeze and flex, squeeze and relax your toes, your calves, move all the way up to your head, hold for 3 seconds, and then release. Mm-hmm. And what you're doing is you're releasing that energy or anxiety mm-hmm. in different Tension. Parts of your body. So if we're bedridden, moving, stimulating the brain cognitively can be helpful too. Visualizing movement to keep that mind-body connection sharp so when you can move again. You know, there's all those physical therapies to help people, even bedridden, if able, to get some sort of movement in.
Love that.
So starting very small.
Great answer. That's really fascinating too with the muscle flex and then releasing it. And ideally that muscle is more relaxed than it was initially because we have that low-grade mm-hmm. tension.
Right.
Let's go to the practical, maybe probably more common one is, okay, I'm a CEO. I'm 40 years old, busy man, to say the least, married, three kids. Mm-hmm. I can't afford to walk every day, like 10,000 steps. I'm not going to do cardio. I really just have to be successful and super efficient with my time. Mm-hmm. And how would you kind of approach a guy like that where he's like in the mindset of, I can't afford to spend time doing certain things like that. I want to be healthy. I want to stay, you know, fit physically, but I just don't. I just can't. Mm-hmm. Business is too important.
Yeah. So it comes down to the values. And I think if somebody understands and not, it goes back to that narrative that people might tell themselves. If you understand how important movement is, all the benefits, brain, body, you know, it's needed for longevity, right, and will help you feel better. It will actually help you be more efficient as a CEO.
Come on.
And stimulate your brain, and so many amazing capacities allow you to de-stress. So
creativity, yes, effectiveness, yeah.
It's doing way more, has way more benefits than just it's taking time out of my busy schedule. It's actually helping you recharge. So the time one is probably what you hear the most of people not having time. But when we look at our day, and I used to do this with college students, they had block schedules.
This is great.
And if you would block out and show like every single minute of your day, I'm sure you can find 10, 15 minutes. It doesn't have to be long. There's something I used to do, which is funny and not embarrassing. I definitely own it. Is 5 minute jumps.
And 5 minute jumps.
You remember me telling you this, but if I didn't have time for cardio, I knew how important getting my heart rate up. Yeah. I would jump for 5 minutes, listen to the best music soundtrack ever.
Just vibe out.
And get my heart rate up. Mm-hmm. And it's engaging all my muscles. But and back to your example, if you're working, getting a standing desk, forcing yourself to go get some water, do some push-ups mm-hmm. in between meetings.
Yes.
It's hard. You know, I think of work environments where there's a lot of people watching, or like cubicles where everybody can see what you're doing. Maybe go to your car and, you know, walk around the building or do some push-ups in a private space.
Right.
Just something to move your body. And it does not have to be complex, or it doesn't have to take a ton of time.
It's good.
But it's so beneficial.
So good, Gabby. That's the whole mindset of like you don't have time for fitness, but we waste like how many hours on Netflix?
So many hours.
You know, and it's like, it's also like redefining fitness. Fitness doesn't have to be going to the gym.
Right.
You know, like I'm a big proponent of resistance training. So like, if you're not going to go to the gym, I highly recommend, especially guys mm-hmm. who I work with, to get dumbbells, get kettlebells, like use resistance because you're going to build muscle most efficiently. Right. But I'm always fascinated by that. I'm like, to the CEO example, I'm like, you would be a better, more creative, more efficient, clear and calm-minded CEO if you took care of your physical fitness. And more importantly, do you want your business to be around long-term? Well, you got to be around long-term. Right. And the easiest way to burn out is going headlong into mm-hmm. your work and your business, waking up, emails first thing, nonstop, right, no breaks. I'm gonna sleep when I'm dead. Like, that mentality produces burnout, which maybe that's why, or at least connected to mm-hmm. what we see in the States with depression, like mm-hmm. crazy depression, mm-hmm. And anxiety and stress. Mm-hmm. It's never been higher.
Right.
And yet we have so much material stuff. So that's the transition I'm gonna take to, you mentioned dopamine mm-hmm. In relation to depression. I feel like we probably have, what are you looking at?
I thought
you were looking at the studies. But it's interesting with dopamine, I feel like probably higher than ever on a consistent level. You know, maybe back in the day, for instance, as a male, like dopamine hit big time once you like, you know, you brought home dinner for the family, like you went and hunt or gathered vegetables and fruit, like, and you brought dinner to the family, massive dopamine plus the food dopamine. But now it's like, we just have dopamine spikes all day, every day. We wake up, you got dopamine spikes on social, mm-hmm. you got dopamine spikes with TV or entertainment's a big one. So I'm rambling, but what's the connection between dopamine and depression? Is it connected? And then we can go into maybe social media and like what your views are there with mental health and how to maybe put up boundaries. Mm-hmm. So dopamine, depression.
So very interconnected as far as the things that we need. So for somebody that struggles with depressive symptoms, hopelessness, you know, loss of interest in activities. Their dopamine baseline is to the point where they need a lot to feel good. Hmm. It's not at the same bar of somebody who's functioning well. They can, you know, like you, go outside, look at the moon, and feel great.
Honestly, that's not going to
do
high.
It. That's not going to do it.
Right.
So they need to have a lot more energy that they have to expend in order to get those levels to where they need to be to feel that joy and pleasure.
What are common reasons that dopamine gets to that point where you do have such low levels? What are the most common?
Well, I'm going to go back and say trauma.
Yeah, for sure. So trauma actually, in order to protect, it actually minimizes your dopamine release or capacity?
What happens is, and I might be getting this a little bit wrong, but I think what happens is...
Welcome to the podcast. I get stuff wrong all the time.
And I'm blanking for a second. But it's an overdrive of like needing pleasure, trying to compensate for these hardships for so long.
Right.
And it might get paired, like the dopamine things that are being released might be like those unhealthy coping skills that then just kind of damage that system in the long term.
Yeah. Now that's useful to know. What about the social media and how that plays a factor? Like, what do you see that? Because obviously, like, I'm sure there's younger people who, and it's fascinating to me who are listening. It's fascinating to me. We were kind of blessed in a way to not get bombarded with social at like third grade. You know, it's very much like out playing with the neighborhood boys.
Right.
My entire life up till, up till like, even in high school, we still got outside so much. But now our culture is one of such entertainment, like inundated with entertainment. And a lot of that's goes back to the movement. We're sitting, we're seated typically when we're being entertained. But yeah, I just think social media is such a, it's such a powerful tool.
Mm-hmm.
Amazing, right? Mm-hmm. It's got tons of benefits. I've been able to use it, and Josh too. Like, if we didn't have it, there would be a lot of limitations. But how do you see that playing into the depression or anxiety? Like, how big of a deal is social media in relation?
I think it's one of the biggest deals for that, because how it works is, and this, I experience this too, but I'm mindful of it. So I hopefully am able to get myself out when this happens. But
keyword mindful. That's really good. Like, you know, if you, if you're not aware, you're on autopilot and you're just reacting.
Right. And that's what happens is we'll go into our phone, and I'm saying, well, cause I'm assuming this happens to most people, to send a message. And then you click on a social media app and you're like, what am I doing here?
Happened to me like literally today.
Something reinforces you while you're on it where you don't get off it. You see something that brought you value, pleasure, made you laugh, you learn something, and then dopamine spikes. And not did it reward that one tiny moment, it rewarded the entire system, picking up your phone, pressing that app, going into that app, forgetting about messaging, whatever it is, it rewires or it reinforces that whole thing. So the issue with social media is it's giving us lots of dopamine, it's reinforcing one small aspect of it, whether it's we're laughing at a video, something we're taking value in, but we're spending way too much time to get that material when we can be getting that in other ways.
Right.
And it's even more so damaging for developing brains. So if you're over 25 and you're doing this, just be mindful. But under 18, like 25, our brain's still being developed, and it's very harmful. And we're in such a comparative culture right now, when like I go back and we talked about those seeds being planted, if someone believes they're unworthy of love or not beautiful enough or physically fit enough, and then now they have access to compare themselves to everybody in the world and choose what evidence they're going to hold on to and discard, they're going to hold on to the evidence that feeds into that belief.
Wow.
And that's a lot of evidence at our fingertips when if we're going through day to day, we don't have access to all these athletes or models or whatever the comparison is.
Not to mention even the best of the best are like, we still have the filters. We still have the, you're picking the best angle. We're all guilty. I mean, I'm guilty of it. Like I'll pick the better angle of myself. If I have three photos, naturally you want to just show the better angle.
Right. How we're wired, it's fine.
Yeah.
But yeah, so having boundaries with social media is really great. And I know my husband's very good at this, and I'm trying to be better with it. It's hard when it is part of your job of marketing, to set those boundaries. But it's so important to just think about like how much time you're spending and how much life you're missing during those moments. Mm. What other things you could be doing and experiencing or being present in your day to day. So
that's so good.
When we're parents, I'm going to have very strict social media rules, and
same.
I don't even know how I'm going to tackle that. And I know they're not going to like it, but
same.
It is what it is.
Gianna's not getting a phone until she's 26.
I know. I'm like 18. No,
dude,
monitored.
100%. By the way, we need comfier chairs in the studio. I was like, my left leg was like falling asleep, and now I'm goofily like,
it's just the cord.
And by the way, I was thinking I could have easily put it on the L stand we have somewhere. And I'm like, okay, you're just.
You
dumb,
want me
Brian.
To move?
Actually good. Okay. I'm actually very much comfortable now.
You're situated.
Yeah, but yeah, it's so this is so good. It's so needed. There's so many good things you just said there too, specifically with. Well, actually, let me pause. Josh, what do you think he does well? He does the timer. He does time limits on social, right?
He has a timer. He also just was super aware that that's not something that he was compatible with, of being on his phone for however long. So he was able to just be super mindful to say, okay, I'm on it. It's not serving me a purpose.
Yep.
I'm wasting time. I could be doing a million other things. And he's really good about getting out of the zone if he slips into it.
That's good.
And I watch that and admire it because it is difficult.
I admire him on many fronts. I admire you guys both. But that's a big deal. I think, too, what you said is so important because now that we, Gigi and I do have baby Gianna, the most beautiful little girl ever.
She is.
It's insane. I'm super aware of, like, you know, I don't spend the same amount of time as I did before on social because of that. Mm-hmm. Obviously, like, I would spend more time when I got home just naturally, not having a baby. But then the dog changed that. Mm-hmm. And then Gianna, of course. But it does really force you to try to be more efficient with your time and then just decompress, be present with her and with the family. Mm-hmm. But that's a big, big deal. And I think one thing that I do I'm sharing it because maybe it'll help somebody, is I take way too many photos and videos. Everyone knows that, you included. But what I really try to do, especially out when I'm living, because it's a big difference if I'm here by myself versus out to dinner, is I will maybe take a photo or video, but I will just record it and put it away. Mm-hmm. And I'm very much, I think you're in the same boat where you document, but then at that time after dinner, everyone's kind of hanging out. Maybe you're by yourself for 5-10 minutes. Mm-hmm. That's when I post. Mm-hmm. And I like that because if I am constantly documenting, then going to Instagram, then putting the text on there or the filter or the caption, and you post, it's a 10-minute, 5-minute ordeal. Whereas you could just document it, have the photos for later in the videos,
right,
and then be able to like be present in the moment. So
that's so true. And I definitely do that. I have so many photos that I just am capturing and I don't do anything with, but they're there. So I just finding them in my memories, but.
And your folders on your phone. Your reels, by the way, side note, are like documentaries. They're so good. They're like mini movies.
Because I take so many pictures and videos just of life, little things that bring me joy, memories that I want to hold on to. But I have, it's a very embarrassing number of how many photos are on my phone. So if I'm trying to relive a trip. Yeah,
let's see who's more embarrassing.
I don't even know.
If you want to relive a trip, sorry.
Okay. If I want to relive a trip, I mean, now in photos, we can search beach and it can pop up. Sure. But prior to that, I would get lost and I'm like, I don't remember what year that adventure was to go back. So I love making reels on my personal page because it's a memory like folder and it has music and it just brings everything to life that I experience.
That's
which
beautiful.
Is why my reels are so long, and I'm very non-tech savvy, so
I'm looking at my number and it's not good.
Mine's so bad. It's embarrassing. Oh, I must have deleted some.
I was gonna say I did too, but it's still not. What's your video at?
Oh, video?
Mm-hmm.
See it. I'm so.
It's at the very bottom. Media types.
Oh, videos, 15,447.
Dang. That's bigger than me. Really? I'm at 9K, so yep. I feel and good. What about photos?
Photos, I am at, scrolling back, 70,394.
Okay, cool, 79K. So we're both in a similar boat.
It was 88 last time I looked, so I think wow. I deleted some.
That's amazing. I'm glad to know I'm not the only one out there, because I always felt like from a young age, and that's mm-hmm. probably playing a role in what Josh and mm-hmm. I do and love to do, is document, create, mm-hmm. share stuff with the world. And it's also for us too. It's not just for the world, but it's like, right. I love the process of creating. Mm-hmm. And I always believed, because I always took photos from a young age, once I got a camera, I always wish I had more photos. Wow. And I was like, I just wish I took a photo of that, because that was right. awesome, and now I don't have it. So if anything, I would rather have the photo.
Overcompensating.
Right. So that's why the practice of like documenting, putting it away is yep. a very essential thing, because I would just be on my phone and yeah. on the camera.
I need to get better at how many photos I take of one thing. I have 15 True. Pictures of my yeah. breakfast bowl.
I hear you.
My food is probably the majority on my phone right now.
You're a big foodie. Big foodie.
Big foodie.
Okay, so how do you find in all this conversation so good, like how do you find work-life balance for you? Because I gotta imagine, so what you do and the trauma and the conversations, it can be very deep. Mm-hmm. And some people can relate to that, whether it's a toxic work environment or they're just dealing with heavy stuff, trauma,
right.
literally at the hospital maybe. How do you... Oh my gosh, my Siri just popped on. That was wild.
So confused.
1 second.
Okay.
That's crazy. Dude, you guys see an iRobot? That's what's going to happen, dude. The robots are coming for us. Siri was like, oh, I have the answer to your question. Don't ask your nice friend Gabby to answer that. So anyway.
Thanks, Siri. But yeah. I didn't hear what she said.
So. Thanks, but no thanks. How do you decompress? How do you, in your own personal life? I imagine it's similar answers, but maybe what's like an unpopular or uncommon way you cope or mm-hmm. or improve your mental health with the lifestyle?
So I think the main thing that I do and I've always done is being able to tune in and like be very present with my body and signals of how I'm feeling, mm-hmm. very in touch with my emotions and express them a lot. But yeah. Like
to,
for
to
example,
Josh.
Yeah, here's a lot. When I was working in a nonprofit agency, it was a lot of work. It was a high caseload, all trauma. Mm. It for a while I was able to withstand the emotional burden, and I was really good about when I came home, you know, and I had so many cases of clients texting or suicidal thoughts, like things that I would have to turn back on for. Mm. But unless I got something like that, I was home and I was present. And
yeah.
The first thing I did is I would take a shower, and that was my cleanse of like figuratively
yeah.
just washing away all of the stress that yeah. I had for my day, the sense of things. Being in the, like showering is also really good of just getting your mind to turn off. It's just very mindless
yeah.
activity. So mm-hmm. for me, that's what it was. And then I was able...
And it's stimulating your skin and all
right.
that, so it's kind of
all
able,
the senses, right. the smell of the shampoo, all of those things. So that was my quick reset that I would do initially, and then just be present and balance it. But when I could feel that wasn't working, it was different signals for me. I was having dreams of like processing through trauma with clients or
wow.
bad things happening, and it was taking a toll where it was kind of seeping into my brain in a way that I didn't have a good enough barrier. So then I had to take an evaluation, and I said, you know, this is too much emotionally for me to handle. And that's where I made the transition to working with adults and mm-hmm. having my own practice where I could decide what my caseload would be. You know, when we have kids, feel really more balanced and less traumatized from what I was doing before. So
yeah.
I just knew when it was at that point where I wasn't able to handle it, and I figured out how to change it.
Yeah.
So knowing when you're at your capacity for burnout.
Huge.
There's lots of different ways your body can signal that you're feeling that, and especially if it's tapping into your joy for other things.
True.
Like if I'm home and I'm not present
yeah.
with my husband, that something is affecting it.
Yeah.
It's tapping into the joy of these other environment. So that's when I know something needs to change. And it wasn't in line with my value system to work that much. Mm-hmm. I needed the balance. I needed to travel. I needed to create my own schedule, have time for healthy meals.
Yep.
And I wasn't getting that. So I made that switch. So
awareness and then positive action.
Positive action, yeah.
Boundaries.
And that's hard to do. Like, mm-hmm. I was fortunate enough to take that leap and be able to take the steps to do that. But it might be small scale of, okay, I'm stressed that I don't have time to go grab lunch or eat a healthy meal, so I'm going to have to meal prep.
Mm-hmm.
And that's going to make me feel better in my work environment as a recharge.
Yep.
Or I'm going to have to fit in my workout in the beginning of the day because that will help me balance myself at work and do something fun on weekends, whatever it is. Meal delivery services, like for groceries.
Huge.
Can help. You know, I always remember being working like so many hours Monday through Friday and then 2 days to do laundry.
Yeah.
Buy groceries, prep for the next work week. And it was like a hamster wheel and didn't like that pattern.
Yeah.
So finding ways to kind of decompress
and
setting aside time for that self-care is so important.
Right. I'm reading I love that, by the way. And I'm reading a book too, side note, called The Anatomy of the Soul.
Ooh,
You would actually love it. And it's specifically about, I believe it's a Christian author. And he's talking about just the connection there, like literally with your brain, with your brainstem, your memory, your senses, your emotions, your feelings, like how all those things like are like you can experience something transcendent or or eternal, something like God, right? So I guess my question would be, do you find that the mental and spiritual are more of the same? Because I know you mentioned like, I mean, how we, in that book says it, like how we experience God is very much like a scientific, like it's stuff within the brain that we can actually like experience God with. If we didn't have the capacity to do so in our mind, then maybe there wouldn't be a way. So I'm just curious if it's mental, spiritual is the same thing, if it's different for you.
I think of it as a component of like, what's needed as far as like fully to function and to feel our best and to know our identity and things like that is having that connection and tapping into something that we believe in can help us understand our values and our identity and serve as like a compass for things in life. And missing that component sometimes is a little bit more difficult to navigate life circumstances if we don't have that foundation of figuring out what do we believe when things are outside of our control. How do we comprehend that and conceptualize that? So having a spiritual foundation in things is important too.
Yeah. Heck yeah. And I think spiritual too, just to like explain for me, especially in that question, I'm thinking like just beyond the on paper, beyond the here's the evidence, here's what it is. Because to me, it's like there is stuff we can't explain that is very much real. Mm-hmm. And if not, it could be like the most real thing. Who knows? But it's just one of those.
This is all fake reality.
maybe. But it is, that's always fascinated me for sure. Just that whole idea. Mm-hmm. I was going to follow up with that with something. Hope. Like I read something the other day and, you know, I have a couple more last questions. I know we're over an hour. But hope and faith, that's got to play a big role in mental health because when we lose that, we alluded to at the very beginning of this, when you don't have hope, everything just seems forced, or you start to lose your excitement and life. Mm-hmm. And so, yeah, I heard a quote, I read it, that faith gives you hope so you can approach the future from a place of like confidence and not fear.
Right.
And no, I love
that's very powerful and true. And why the spiritual part of wellness is so discussed, because without, like, we know there's things without our control, and we know there's so many circumstances that can put somebody at rock bottom where they lose all of that hope. They've tried and have gone through challenge after challenge. So it's hard to stay optimistic and hopeful, but having that higher power to look up to and to know, like, okay, I'm not alone in this, whatever I believe in is kind of like my anchor or my compass to kind of pull me out and through to this. So
right.
It is important in that way for sure.
It's good. It's really important to cultivate hope, like build your hope, build your faith and ways that however you see fit, like do that. Cause it's going to pay you dividends. Maybe for a later podcast, another thing I was going to ask you during the conversation about just like humans are, we're so fascinating because we are capable of so much good, but so much evil. But it's also the idea of like hurt people do hurt people, right? So trauma does kind of play a massive role in like the evil we're capable of. And I'm always, I always chuckle too, because when people say like unimaginable evil, there's no such thing. Meaning like if we're capable of doing it, like it's imaginable, right? So it's kind of interesting. And I think with what you do after having those conversations, I'm proud of you for like being such a what's the right word? Optimistic, that's the word. Optimistic and grounded person, individual who still has like hope, who still exudes like good energy and confidence, because it's so easy to lose that.
It really is. And I still struggle with it. I'm not, I wouldn't say I'm super optimistic given what I know and what I've seen, but it's a balance of how to be prepared, or like, I just think in the parenting aspect, because that's just so important. And future of our society. So parents have a really big role, and you know, how to shelter kids and protect kids, for me, for knowing how much awful things can happen, and statistically speaking, the odds of that. So give them knowledge and education to say, okay, these are things that we're going to normalize. And I can get into this. I would love to do a whole parenting podcast.
Yeah, we honestly should. That is
part of my background as well.
Yeah.
Give them knowledge to be able to still see the world in a beautiful way, but be prepared and competent, and to know, okay, what is safe and what is unsafe, and how to establish boundaries or communicate if something feels like something happened and it wasn't right, or affected them emotionally.
That's good.
So just feeling like, okay, I know there's things that can be really bad in this world, and but I also know there's really good things in this world, and being able to be prepared and know how to cope and kind of go through those motions and balancing it.
Super good. So hypothetically, and we'll kind of land the plane, hypothetically, you become a mother, right? What is something you would tell yourself in preparation for it? Like what's something you, what kind of mom do you want to be? Like what do you want your future kid to maybe know about mom? And I think in this, I think in the, and the answer, it could help other moms out there kind of like re-anchor to what's important, because I think it's, you're just scrambling, but you often lose sight of like, well, most important thing is this.
Right. Well, knowing what I know, like from being a parenting educator, I know, you know, I can't just go in and wing it, and I have to take a good look of like how to foster the most nurturing environment for our future children. So the thing I would tell myself is that I have all the abilities to do this, that it's all within me, especially with the foundation of love.
Yeah.
And with the goal of protection, yet leniency. We talk about like in a parenting capacity, it's a backbone parent that can sway. Like we're strict and rigid, but we can sway towards leniency and
that's cool.
Forgiveness that's and things like that. So having structure and a foundation of core values and things that I want to instill, but then being able to lean where I'm not like so rigid and there's resentment and things that stem from that. So,
I know with all this like parenting trauma and I talk with guys all the time who are dads, like, oh yeah, like my dad did this. And it's like, well, like, and now we're dads, like we're just hopefully not traumatizing our kids extremely.
Like they're gonna, nobody gets a course. Like most of the time, parents parent how the way they were parent, and things are so automatic. Like, you know, saying no and responding to things in emotional way, or saying you can do it, or at least you tried. Whatever it is, it's so habitual from what was modeled to us. But we know there's research out and ways to do things that might be a little bit different. Not that our parents ever, you know, some did do harm, but were intentionally harming. In the safe environments, but emotionally it could have happened. So
yeah, that's good. So one adjective, maybe let's say that one adjective you would want your future child or children to think of you.
To think of me?
When they say mom, she is I'll describe her with this adjective. What do you want that word to be today? It can change, of course.
I mean, I think loving is just the main one.
Yeah, that's awesome.
I mean, all things revolve around that. That would be good qualities of compassion and empathy and kindness and dedicated, all of those things.
Love conquers all. It's also, I love the Bible verse that says, faith, hope, and love, and the greatest of these is love. You need faith, you need hope. Like, we all live with faith. Mm-hmm. We just put our faith in trust in different things.
Right.
You need hope, unless you don't live.
Mm-hmm.
Right? And then you need love. Like, it's love. I believe the world was created out of love, and like the only reason for it all is love, and that's the answer, and that's the goal, and that's the prize. So
right.
I think living from a place of love and also loving your children is the best definition of success. So I love that. And then I guess a question as we end, what's a question that I didn't ask that you wish I did?
Oh, let me think. You know, I think it was, you asked so many amazing questions and
I just winged it. So that's great to hear.
No, it was really great. And I think we touched on a lot and hopefully everybody got, you know, a few takeaways at least from this. The only thing I would say would be like the technical aspects of trauma and defining them and the steps in overcoming it and things. Well, I know we did touch on that. So I think it would just be like statistics and more of the details of trauma. But
so, but in light of that, though, that's a good point. In light of that, from a traumatic standpoint, or we, each of us have trauma. And the crazy part about trauma, at least in my opinion, is it's relative. So like some person's trauma, the way they feel that trauma can be the exact same thing as this person's trauma, the same level, but it's a whole different like experience. So how do you go? What's the stage or what's the process? And is it possible to go from traumatized and maybe paralyzed to, okay, I'm recovering, I'm healing, and now I'm free?
Right. So trauma is actually the wound that the event creates rather than the event itself.
So it's the byproduct,
right?
The fruit from that.
And the two different types, and I'll be brief about this, is the macro trauma. So the events that create a wound immediately, right after that event or during while it's happening.
That's
that
a macro.
Macro trauma. So big earth-shattering moments that are happening. And then the micro traumas are things that are creating that same wound over time. Bullying, living in a household with a parent that has substance use issues, and seeing the progression in the wound happening over time. Emotional abuse, things like that. They're creating these wounds, and then now as an adult, you know, that's what has to be discussed and untangled. But acknowledging that it's there and knowing that there are ways of overcoming it. And if you're struggling with anything brain health related, and you can look back and say there's a macro micro trauma in my past and I haven't addressed it, that's the first step.
Okay.
Understanding how the brain and body works, your brain stored that traumatic memory and the physiological wound and response to that.
Right.
And we talk about trauma healing as far as like cleaning out a wound. If you scrape your knee and you just let the skin heal over, that's still there.
Right.
The gravel's still in there. It's not getting cleaned out. We kind of have to do the painful part of going back and processing through it to heal.
Yeah.
And if we're not doing that, it's just going to come forward in other ways in our life. So going back, like
overcompensating,
like I said,
whatever
the traits are.
Yeah.
And then doing the movement, feeding your body nutritious things for fuel, and that would be the way to heal, and being really intentional about your thoughts and saying to yourself, okay, what seeds am I watering and helping grow? Are they the toxic seeds? Or are they the flourishing, like, you know, healthy seeds? And then figuring out how to change that and rewire it through repetition.
So good.
So that would be in a nutshell.
That's amazing. We didn't talk much about community. We did a little bit, but that is such a big deal. From
so
a mental
many.
Health standpoint, like a positive group of people,
right.
community is so essential, you know?
And there's a lot of resources out there. You know, I do create a blog post every
week. Yeah, plug your stuff. Like,
every
week. Where can people find you?
So Instagram, I'm the_healthycoconut. My website is thehealthycoconut.com. And I share weekly blog posts on different things related to trauma so people can learn and educate themselves, because I think that education is the foundation of healing, and having that wisdom is first step.
Yeah.
But yeah, there's so many resources out there if anybody needs them or can reach out and I can provide them. So.
Amazing. And if you're listening and you don't have friends like Gabby, that's your action step is, again, the community and the voices in your life and all that. So I'm super grateful to have a friend like you. I'm super grateful for your husband. You guys are amazing people. So I think that's what it's all about, is like getting in conversations and learning from each other, connecting to each other, and striving to be more empathetic, be more loving, be more understanding, and understanding like we're all in the same boat. We're all in the same experience we call life.
We're all humans.
We're all human. We're all flawed. Yeah. We all have trauma we're trying to work through. Some of us are working well. Some of us are struggling. Mm-hmm. But like that struggle is also a part of everyone's struggle in a way. So I think that connected nature to end is a big idea.
Yes. Great way to end.
Heck yeah.
So true.
Well, I'm super glad. This is an amazing combo. You had fun?
Yes, it was great.
We made it through. No tech issues. It was great.
No.
So
no Siri interrupting. We're good.
Yes. Yeah, exactly. That was so bizarre. But yeah, thank you so much, Gabby. You guys are amazing. If you love the show, if you feel like it would help someone in your life, if it helped you, chances are it will help more people. So highly recommend or encourage you, invite you to share this on social media with a friend or with a family member, and I'm just super grateful for you guys. So get and stay physically, mentally, and spiritually fit, and we'll see you next time.